it is Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
There's a long tradition of largely secular Reform Jews looking at America and being like, maybe you guys should go to church more. And, you know, maybe you should.
Hi, I'm Jerusalem Demsis.
I'm Matthew Iglesias.
And welcome back to The Argument. Matt is in studio because today we're reading Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam, and he wants to practice what this book preaches.
We need deep connections.
Yes.
Interpersonal.
It's in. He's just here for this book club, and he will be remote again for a few weeks. But then... And then we'll be back in person.
You know what? I was here to do other things in person.
No.
Things in my community.
No.
To help out other kids at my son's school. You know, I'm participating in social life.
Good for you.
As we should. So what is this book? Why are we reading
this? So probably most people have heard of, who are listening to this podcast, have heard of Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam. But this is a book, comes out in 2000, and it is making the argument that there's this mass decline in American associational life. Titular example is, of course, bowling leagues, but he talks a lot about things like rotary clubs, churches, unions, all these sorts of kind of membership organizations that, you know, folks who are familiar with like kind of Tocqueville discourse is made up a lot of what made America distinct for most of its history. And he charts kind of the decline of this throughout the latter half of the 20th century and talks about like the causes and consequences. And as you can tell, this is like quite a long book. Matt and I were surprised. We thought this was going to be like a 200 pager. It was not. But he gets into like, you know, it's both kind of a social science descriptive book, and also he's giving you his best guesses at what the root causes of this are. And like, I think that like this has spurred, even in modern times, like a ton of discourse. Like whenever anyone's talking about the loneliness epidemic, or they're talking about, you know, people spending, you know, not dating anymore, or whatever, like Putnam invariably comes up, Bowling Alone invariably comes up. But like, I feel like this is like, I mean, we've done a lot of books in this series so far. Like, I think all of them are mentioned in this book. like Silent Spring by is mentioned in this book. Jane Jacobs' Death and Life of the Great American Cities is mentioned in this book. Betty Friedan, The Feminine Mystique, is mentioned in this book. But this is like, it, as evidenced by that, this is coming later. And so it's very different. And I think you were like at Harvard when this book came out.
Yeah. So, I mean, I do think, I think we should shout out the readers who suggested this.
Oh, yes.
Because it really is in the tradition of those other books, as seen by the fact that, like, he incorporates them all into his narrative. It's also, you can tell, though, that the standards of quantitative evidence for, like, a big ideas book have shifted between 1960 and 2000. This book has really egregiously designed Microsoft Excel charts. There's all these, like, totally unnecessary 3D bar charts and things like that.
What is this?
Well, there's that one. That one's not so bad, the line chart. But,
it's a little bad.
But it is different. There is a lot of data, a lot of statistics. I also have a different experience of this book because I was alive. I never took a class that Robert Putnam taught at Harvard, but I was there on campus when this book came out. I was aware of the discourse around it in real time.
Yeah.
I pretended to have read this book at the time, participated in conversations about it. I even was as a college student, I was part of some group that the Partnership for Excellence in Government had put together, where there were like different college students from fancy schools, and they brought us to DC like three or four different times. I don't know, talk about like youth engagement with the political system.
Yeah.
And so people were like talking about this like all the time, you know. And I was a teenage political junkie at a time when like the general level of political engagement in the United States was like way lower than it is now. So like people who cared about politics, grown-ups, were like really interested in like the fact that I was interested in politics and like wanted to know like Putnam, blah, 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 blah. I was genuinely surprised how little discussion of bowling is in the, I mean, I knew that this was not a book about bowling,
yeah,
obviously,
yeah,
but I would have told you that the reason that this, you know, when pretending to read it, that the reason this book is called Bowling Alone is that the central metaphor that he discusses,
yeah,
is that although Americans continue to bowl in high numbers in the 1990s, the formal bowling leagues have declined. So people are engaged in recreational pursuits, but they don't have this kind of formal membership-based organization.
Yeah.
And that means that there's a loss of a certain kind of ambient interconnectivity, mm-hmm, amongst people that can be formally deployed. That's actually, I mean, the book does say that fact about bowling, but it is much more quantitatively concerned with the decline in church attendance,
yeah,
I would say, and actually doesn't hinge that much on the formal versus informal organization, because he talks a lot about the fact that, this sounds more contemporary, but he talks a lot about the fact that people are socializing less.
Yeah.
He says that, like, people are spending less time visiting with friends. They're spending less time, like, hosting dinners. He introduces people to the Yiddish term schmooze, mm-hmm, and then, like, discusses it at great length. And so I don't 100% understand the literal significance of the league versus individual.
Well, I think what it is that, to my knowledge, Robert Putnam is not a very religious man. And I think that, like, secular people who are concerned about the decline in associational life are not going to want to read a book that's about, like, you should go to church and, like, no one goes to church anymore, because it reads like this is a social conservative telling you that, like, the decline in American, like, civil society is all because no one goes to church anymore.
His findings, right, the descriptive findings they're just, like, quite a bit broader.
Yes.
Than this kind of, like, are you in a bowling league or are you just bowling?
I think that you're just a very literal person.
I am a very literal, yeah, person. No. But I mean, it's just much more directly the ancestor of super contemporary concerns about,
yes,
like, people socializing less, et cetera, right? So, like, what he's actually finding in the book is that the bowling situation is exceptional.
Yeah.
Because, like, yeah, people aren't in bowling leagues, but they're still bowling.
Yeah.
But, like, broadly speaking, what he's finding is that it's not like people stopped going to church and joined book clubs instead.
Well, I think the analogy still kind of holds because, I mean, at least I haven't looked at this today, but, like, from the book's perspective, while people stopped going to church, belief remained pretty high and self-reported adherence to religion remained higher than at least,
yes,
attendance did, which I think is, like, kind of the similar metaphor where, like, I mean, I think this is true of a lot of things, like chess, like, people don't really do formal chess in person, but, like, chess is more popular than ever because of chess.com. Or, like, I think that metaphor still holds.
Sure,
that,
I guess. But, yeah. But I mean, I think in some ways the most potent chapter in the book is just the one about television.
Yeah.
Where he shows that, like, the big thing that has happened time use wise across this period is, like, people watch more television.
Yeah.
And he talks about how, you know, he shows, like, technology adoption, you know, of, like, dishwashers and all different things. And, like, television was like a rocket ship, right?
Yeah.
And then we went from three channels to cable and, you know, VCRs and all this stuff. And he talks about, I mean, this will sound so quaint to people, but I remember this, like, when I was a kid, most people had only one television.
Yeah.
But it was, like, increasingly common across the 80s and 90s for families to have multiple televisions.
Mm-hmm.
So that, like, instead of the whole family watching a show together, like, different people will be watching different things. And this is obviously continued as we all have our pocket TVs and stuff. But so, you know, he is documenting a big decline in Americans' participation in almost every activity that isn't commuting alone in your car,
mm-hmm,
or watching television in your house.
I do think that you're, like, you being attracted to the TV chapter is less a function of, like, him making that a central part of the book and more a function of, like, we are now in 2026 and, like, watching the collapse of people's, like, offline time because they have, like, as you said, pocket TVs everywhere they go. But, like, I actually, when I read this book, it did not feel to me like it was, like, he was putting a special emphasis
on
technology.
I agree. I'm saying, like, I think that finding,
yeah,
is, like, when he does his pie chart,
yeah,
TV is the quantitatively most significant part, but it does not receive equivalent weight in the actual text of the book. Like, he wants a dog. And I think this annoyed a lot of people at the time.
Yeah.
And probably you in retrospect as well. But, like, he goes on at, like, great length about essentially the impact of second wave feminism.
Yeah.
Right? Which, like, when he finally totals it up, he attributes, like, actually relatively little of the decline of associational life to this, but it takes up more room in the book than his discussion of any other factor.
Okay, we're going to get into, like, the full argument that he's making, but I think I just want to, like, preview. I think I came into this book, like, trying to force myself not to come in, like, so much with my priors, which are that, like, while I think it's obvious that people are not hanging out in person, I mean, just, like, obvious whether or not you look at statistics or not, but like the statistics also say this, that people don't hang out in person as much, that there is a growing prior in the academy, even when he was there. I mean, he's still around, but like when he was writing this book, that like individualism in American society is like a sickness and that it is like the root cause of like so much of what's gone wrong. And this book reads to me as someone who like came in like hating the idea that like people are not beholden to these like local communities, and then like is looking for anything at all to attach that to. And that's like a fundamentally like small C conservative position. So I wasn't surprised when I got to like the second wave feminism section. He's like talking on and on about whether it's the case that women working in the workplace now is the cause of not having as much associational life. I was like, yeah, like that's how you end up. Like that's where you end up when you become like excessively concerned with like the decline in like local communities. And I think that there's a lot in this book which, you know, is relevant for our current moment, but it did not strike me as a book where someone was like honestly coming to a specific problem and then trying to solve it in like a very rigorous academic way. It came in as like someone, which I know I've read Putnam's other book, Making Democracy Work in Italy, about Italy. And that one does read that way. And this one read very much to me as like, I've decided that this is the biggest problem in American society. I'm not really going to be able to justify to you why it's like an independent variable that's causing all of these things. But like, you have to just like buy that this is true. And I like recognize here, like I'm the weird one, that like most people who are probably listening to this or like who have like come across this debate in public are just like, yeah, it's like obviously true to me that the decline in American associational life is like the root cause of a bunch of problems. But I just felt like this book didn't actually convince me of that.
Okay, but I have not read the Italy book.
Yeah.
But like,
I read it a while ago. I was in college, so I don't know. But
right. But I mean, that's like a more academic-y book that many fewer people read. Obviously, we didn't have like Time magazine cover stories about like the divide between Northern and Southern Italy. But like, that's what like he made his bones on.
Yeah.
Right. And like, I think I'm just guessing, but like, I think if you like want to find the part where he like really, really, really tries to prove that social capital is like causally significant for these important governance outcomes, that's like more in the more academic book.
Well, to be clear, I actually think the reason why I liked it is because, I mean, this is to my recollection. Again, I read it like more than a decade ago. He actually doesn't make a bunch of claims that are far beyond what he can find, which is that like he finds this like strong correlation between places in Italy with strong civic associational life and then places that have like better outcomes on various democratic measures. And he like shows this correlation and makes this broader argument. And like in this book, like there's constant slippage. Like there's constant slippage between like, are we talking about social capital, which is like a very like actually specific term that he's using, are we talking about trust? Is, and then he makes like these really big sweeping claims about how like all Americans are like disaffected and disconnected. Like, I actually think that like in ways that discredit the argument, because I mean, as we'll talk about, like while a lot of the problems he's talking about are true, like, you know, it's not the case that like most Americans are feeling disconnected. Like there's a Pew Research poll from 2025 and it finds that 47% of people say they hardly ever / never feel lonely or isolated from people around them. Only 16% of people say all or most of the time. And like, this is something I think people who are really careful about this work like are really clear about. I mean, we have an episode coming up with Derek Thompson about this topic, but you know, there's a difference between like people being alone and people feeling lonely and people feeling bad and malaise. And there's like, I have a lot of skepticism when people feel really, really comfortable extrapolating the vibe that they feel to the entirety of the American people, particularly because, I mean, like the vibe that you yourself are feeling is like obviously like heavily related to your specific location and area. And it's like, to me, a bit weird to assume that, you know, a Harvard professor who I think now is living in New Hampshire can like speak to like the disaffected feelings of everyone in like a 330 million person country. And I just that sort of thing, like, really, I feel like, turned me off.
Yeah, let's take a break here and then we'll be back. The Argument is brought to you by Forkful. Eating well can be difficult when life gets busy. So many meal kits promise convenience, but they require prep and cleanup and ultimately don't save you that much time, and they're not that tasty. Forkful is different. Forkful is meals that prioritize flavor, function, and health. They've got zero seed oils. It's chef-cooked, fresh, never frozen, ready-to-eat meals made with high-quality premium proteins and fresh vegetables. These are delicious menus that fit your lifestyle, your meal preferences. If you want to be gluten-free, if you're on a keto diet, if you're dairy-free, if you're plant-based, they've got you covered. If you want to order off their general menu, they've got you covered there. Eating well does not need to be complicated. With fully prepared, delicious, healthy meals, no meal prep, no cooking, no cleanup, just clean flavors and ready in under 3 minutes, it'll be delivered right to your door within 24 to 48 hours. Explore our plans and menu of fresh, ready-to-eat meals at ForkfulMeals.com and use code ARGUMENT to get 50% off your first order. That's ForkfulMeals.com/argument and use promo code argument for 50% off. Thanks to Forkful for sponsoring this episode.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Okay, now that we're back, I think... You know, this sort of like falls into a slippage point where the book is like before your time, but not really before my time.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like we have to go back to an America of 25, 26 years ago.
Okay.
It was like recent enough that like I was around then, that Robert Putnam is still around and, you know, doing interviews and stuff. But it was a different country. You know, in a lot of ways, it was a much more conservative country than we are now. And as much as public, you know, this was a time when, interracial marriage was like a 50-50 proposition in a Gallup poll, in which, you know, public acceptance of gay couples was very, very low. Bill Clinton tried to get a gay man confirmed to be ambassador to Luxembourg, and he couldn't.
Yeah.
And that was the entire reason that was given for not confirming him. And academia and the media were like more to the right relative to where they are
today
than mass opinion, because there's been polarization across these kinds of things. So like part of what's going on here is that like Putnam was not operating in like today's world when the only people professors are responsive to are like communists. And he's like actually trying to address himself to concerns of cultural conservatives. But also I think a really important part of the debate around this book when it came out, which is the basic descriptive claims.
Yeah.
Because I think a view that a lot of people had at that time was a kind of rah-rah complacency about America that was like center-right coded in a way that like complacency isn't really now. And these people would have been like, see, we have this great book about Italy and then like dysfunctional Southern Italy and like cool, good Milan and Turin in the North. But like America, as we've read in Alexis de Tocqueville, is like super joiner country, right? That like, it's not anti-individualistic. Like we have the smallest welfare state and the most like freedom of any of these countries. But like, we are a free people because we are people of joiners, because we have civil society. We're way more religious than these European losers. Like we got it all figured out. Like we won the Cold War, you know, we're reading our Francis Fukuyama. We're actually pretending to have read it and making it out to be more triumphalistic than it really is.
Yeah.
And like, it's all solved. And a big part of this book's impact is just, A, he's showing that while the levels of this stuff are still relatively high in the United States compared to other countries, that the trends are down. And he's also making this point that, like, we'll come to second nature to, like, a smart person like you about cohort replacement, but that, like, wasn't taken for granted then. But that it's, like, the most religious people the people in the PTA, the people still in the bowling leagues, like these people are all old, mm-hmm. right? And like these habits are sticky and lifelong, right? And like when these Gen Xers and millennials are like in middle age and like we are running everything, the country is going to be markedly different
yeah.
from how it is right now. And to me, like that all holds up. And it continues to hold up, even if you want to have like a more neutral or positive valence about these kinds of changes. I think like people did not believe, like right in the thick of that fight about confirming the ambassador, that 25 years in the future, in like a radically more secular country, mm-hmm. that like that would be totally politically untenable for like right-wing politicians to hold that line, mm-hmm. or that like marijuana legalization would be spreading, you know, from like a libertarian perspective, you would say these are all good changes,
yeah.
that like this like more secular America has just become way more like awesome and loosey-goosey, and like we have gambling apps everywhere and so on and so forth. And I just think like that those trends were coming is like previewed very powerfully and effectively here. And the other thing that we had around the turn of the millennium was you had one group of people who were just like totally poo-pooing the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Like this is nothing. And you had another group of people, which was I think larger, who were these like big internet optimists, particularly in the few years after this, right? So like the thing that like I was saying in the like early zeros was that like we have this like blossoming online community space that is much more two-way. Instead of like one person watching television, you're like in this give and take in forums, that people are finding things that are of special interest to them. They're like, yeah, we're seeing a delocalization and like less engagement with the people who happen to live near you, but more engagement with people who share your interests. And then we're going to have like the world's like greatest Elks Lodge, you know, in the universe, in the comments section of my blog or on like the Reddit page, you know, dedicated to.
But I think it's actually a good place to drill in, because
yeah.
I do think that this is why, I mean, and I will admit right up front here that part of what is different about reading this book is that the debate that this book is intervening in, or is like made to intervene in our modern time, is like so live. And so I'm reading it in the context of like these debates about like loneliness and like what you should do or whatever. And it's like written, you're right, like 20 years before those become like extremely live in the wake of the internet. But I think that like, just to like channel my inner extremely literal person here.
Yeah.
If we were to say the problem with America is that people are not associating with one another enough, whether it's, as he talks about in this book, in many ways, like across different sorts of divides, like whether it's across race or class or whatever it is, or like among people that are very similar to you, like it just seems like descriptively not true that people are actually associating a lot more, as you said, on the internet in various different ways. Now, again, like if you want to make it the claim that like that sort of thing doesn't matter, then I need like a much clearer explanation of like, what is it about association that we're talking about? Because when I criticize, like, or when I think there's a problem with people spending too much time on their phones, it's mostly a problem of like, what are they doing on their phones and what kinds of things are they getting in? Like if people were at home, honestly, like, and on their phones, all they were doing were like reading the argument, listening to the argument, like, you know, and, you know, maybe potentially other books or whatever. I would be like, I don't really think that we would have a lot of the problems we're seeing today. I think the problems come with like, what is the content that is being delivered to people in their homes, and how is it making them feel? How is it making them perceive the world? Are they being like, are they more susceptible to certain kinds of messaging around like populism or like really far right you know, views about things? And so like, to me, like that is how I would conceptualize the problem. But if the problem is like association, I'm like, these kids are like associating way more than anyone else at their age was ever associated. Like, I mean, they're in school and also on their phones. Like when I went home after school, like again, like this was the early aughts or whatever, like I didn't hear from my friends,
mm-hmm.
because I lived kind of far away from the school that I went to. And so then I went home and like I had my family, and then like we didn't have the internet and I read books and like sometimes we'd go to things.
Right.
But like, well, it was just like, now they're like constantly in contact with their friends. They're constantly in contact with them. And so to me, like, I want to be very specific here. Like if the story is really focused on this idea that like repeat interactions with a lot of people that you are in community with is the foundation of like a good democracy, a good society, a place where people will donate their kidneys to one another because they're like know each other. I just like don't think that's true.
Well, okay, so I mean, this is why I wanted more about the bowling leagues actually in the book. No, because I mean, I think that there's an interesting question. You've got a diminished democracy on the shelf here.
And no offense, much better book by Theda Scotchball.
This book I have read.
You've read this one too.
And I did take Theda Scotchball's book. No, but I mean, I read it at the time.
Yeah.
And I took Theda Scotchball's class. Yeah. You know, and one of the points that she makes, right, because she really is making a point about the value of formal membership-based organizations, is that if you have an organization and it has a membership, it can make a decision.
Yes.
Right? Whereas a loose-knit group, whether it's on the internet or at the bowling alley, like literally cannot take collective action, right? So like the American Association of University Professors chose to break with precedent and endorse Abdul El-Sayed in a contested Democratic Party Senate primary. I think that that was dumb. It has received a lot of criticism from a lot of people, but the reason it is like worthy of criticizing is that it is a bona fide collective action.
Yeah.
It is a group of people who associated for the professional purposes of being university professors, making a claim to the public about like what they as a collectivity want to do. And that is the power of associations, right? Like your bowling league can say these tariffs are really bad for American bowlers. No, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas like some guys who bowl can like bitch and moan, or like you can have it on a group text or something. But like the bowling league taking a position qua league about the tariffs can perhaps say to a conservative bowler, like you may like Trump, you may think Democrats are all freaks, you know, like whatever it is. But like we are just trying to talk to you about bowling, right? And has this kind of like cross-cutting nature, right? And again, you know, I mean, he talks about church attendance and how, you know, you have to look at the Black church as a kind of somewhat distinctive institution that like silos people more by race, but like is very, very, very cross-class compared to white churches, right? And so you have these kind of things where like people will come together, right? Like if you go to a synagogue, like everybody there is Jewish, but like by definition, it's a very, it's like a miscellaneous set of Jewish people, like old ones and young ones, et cetera, et cetera. And when those kinds of institutions exist, they can take collective action in a way that like just some guys chatting sort of can't. And I think that we have seen an enormous amount of like internet-based political engagement. And it's like, it's weird because it's heavily dictated by entertainment values because it doesn't like rigorously distinguish between like we are trying to take instrumental political action and like we're just fucking around.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Scotchball's book, for folks who don't know about it, but basically the idea is that the types of associational life that Americans were involved in shifted from these membership-oriented groups towards like groups that are largely like managed. So instead of you're a part of like a union where like you're voting for people to represent you, and then like you're actively engaged in paying, not just only paying dues, but also in, you know, the governance decisions being made, and like it's really relevant to your life, so you're paying attention to it. It shifts to like, oh, like you send some money to like EDF and like they do stuff and like they say they're in your interest, but like you're not really checking and you're not, you maybe you get a calendar. Like, you know, we used to get the Sierra Club calendar when I was young, but like I don't think we ever really engaged in like anything Sierra Club was really doing. And that's actually on the higher end of like membership of groups that have engagement with their local groups. But the thing I actually like reason, I mean, again, like part of this is my own priors coming into this, but part of what I really valued about Scotchball's book is like her, one of her big interventions in the book is to point out that like this Tocquevillian kind of like, or like, you know, I guess, you know, vulgar Tocquevillian kind of view that American association life was really healthy when it was all like super decentralized and localized was like, it's just like totally wrong. That when you go back and you look at the groups that American civic life was really made up of, they're largely like national groups with members. There are like churches that are national that have membership, you know, like they have like a, you know, sites all over the country and congregations all over the country. And then, you know, I forget all the examples in the book, but like the Temperance League, I remember, is like one big one where like that's obviously a national movement that people are involved in locally. And like that's like a very different image of what you would be concerned about going away than if you were to just like have like a sort of cursory reading of Bowling Alone, which, I mean, again, not to harp on the fact of the Bowling League, but like the Bowling League is like, it's one of those things that like does feel like super like localized. Like you're not, I mean, unless you're like, a professional bowler trying to like get like really good. Sure. Like you're just like not, you don't care about the national bowling. You're just like, my buddy's down the block. And I think that like, again, like it's difficult because I'm in some ways criticizing like a surrounding vibe of the arguments rather than like the specific places where he's making these causal claims. But many people I talk to who are reading or engaging this conversation come away from the Putnam discourse from thinking like, oh, the real problem is that like everyone is not like super locally engaged in their like government, locally engaged in their community, like they're not like part of this like specific like local. And I'm like,
I think that what he's saying, right? I mean, again, like I want to emphasize that it was just controversial at the time to be like saying that this associational life was on the decline, right? So part of the overlap between his argument and Scotchwell's argument is that he would get like at first brush a lot of like, but what about this, right? And so like one big what about is that there's been this huge increase in the environmental movement during the period when he's saying associational life is in decline. And part of what he's saying, he can't cite diminished democracy because it wasn't out yet, but they knew each, you know, they worked in the same building. And, you know, so he relies on this same difference that these new post-1970 social movements are these mail order things. Today they would be email lists, right? So like,
but he also criticizes professional associations, which, as you mentioned, like are like very, those are on the up on the same period talking about.
Yes.
And those are like very like representative of their groups.
No, sure.
Know?
But I mean,
like,
you know,
AMA is like a real organization, you know?
Yes and no. You know, he's talking about the group. I mean, I would say essentially like he wants people to go to regular meetings.
Yeah.
Right. And it's why the churches are the most important element of this, even though he doesn't want to dwell on them that much.
Yeah.
Because in terms of like what's a weekly meeting that a lot of people used to go to, that is really the main one. But then he does talk about like there's fewer bridge clubs, there's fewer bowling leagues. Right. So like he is really interested in this like once a week, once a month cadence of meetings that people go to, because that's sort of the difference, right? That like you can join the American Bar Association and never go to a meeting.
Yeah.
Right. You're like in it, but it doesn't, you're not going anywhere, right? Versus like, again, like the PTA.
But I also think it's kind of confusing, right? Because again, like when we, you know, there's a bunch of different statistics as mentioned in this book, but like when you're looking at the people who are like highly involved, that we're talking about a very small percentages of the population. Like, I think that like have like even at the height, when he's talking about at the height of associational life, people that have been involved at like at the level that he's really valorizing, it's like, I think 14%, 15% is what we're talking about. Like some statistics, you have like a 20%, 25%. So like, again, like, in his world where like everything is, he's pointing to these high moments of associational life and everything is going well, 80% of people in his statistics are like not going to meetings. And when they do, like he even mentions, I mean, again, we're excluding the church thing, but like when, even when we're, you know, we're talking about the time, he has like 3.7 hours a month is how much time people were spending in kind of these meetings that he finds really valuable. And I'm like, the breakdown of American life is because people aren't spending 3.7 hours a week together or 3,000 hours a month together. Like, it's just like the whole thing feels like really like trying to force every single thing that's wrong in society and this like mass declensionist narrative into a like communitarian view of the world where I'm just like.
But see, I think part of the view here, right, is that like there is a mass elite of machers, he calls them, who are highly involved in these organizations and are doing things, and that to an extent, like they like hold up the sky.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, you know, like for example, earlier this week, like I'm here in town for this like middle school orientation thing, neighborhood middle school, and the principal of my son's elementary school that he's now finished from, great guy, super engaged principal. There was like two kids who, you know, he's like, he's looking out for them. They're in an iffy kind of home situations. And he wanted to make sure that like they could get to this orientation thing. Mm-hmm. And like their parents couldn't bring them. And so like he reached out to my wife, who's like not here, but who he knows very well from when she was very engaged in the PTA.
Yeah.
And this then, it then like fell to me that I was going to like, for a critical like 12 minutes mm-hmm. one morning, just like make sure that these kids could get to the thing.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's 12 minutes out of my week, my month, right? Like it's very trivial, but it's like actually quite important as just like a little beat in these guys' lives. And it's a piece of connectivity that like Kate and like her one friend who were like super engaged, mm-hmm. like really, really provided to reach out to other kinds of people. And he talks about this in an educational context, right? That like an important determinant of school success is like the basic engagement level of the community, because there is this community level asset of like how many people are around to pitch in when pitching in is needed. And like not that much pitching in is necessarily needed, but whether or not people are available to do it when somebody does need to do it matters, I think, quite a lot. He talks about crime. I mean, he cites Jane Jacobs about this, but again, it's like,
your favorite. You know,
Jacobs's whole point, at least Jacobs is trying to distinguish her like eyes on the street from just like pure mass surveillance.
Yeah.
Right. And the idea is that like some of these like corner store guys who are like there all the time and they know everybody, right, are providing this like externality benefit to everyone. And that the small business people, who are a minority of the stakeholders in the neighborhood, mm-hmm. but because they're physically present all the time and because they have a large stake in it, that like they provide a like security service for everyone. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I think that this is like plausible as an account of how these things go. Now, I do think that when he's like, well, we just like have to like make there be more associations, it's a little bit like, okay, like, what does that mean? You know, mm-hmm. like, he draws a statistical correlation between, he has a bunch of charts in which he essentially shows that, like, the Deep South is totally dysfunctional mm-hmm. and the Upper Plains are, like, really great and New England is, like, second best and so on and so forth. And, you know, it's hard to say. Like, what is the actual thing you would do to cause Mississippi to be more like Massachusetts?
But okay, so like, I don't want to pause you there, because I do think that like you tell a story, which A, like, I'll just note is happening in 2026 of where you are
right.
doing the cooperation, and you're not like in any kind of, I mean, Kate was in the PTA, but like it's like it was not like because of, if the PTA didn't exist, I think Kate would still be like quite involved in your guys's
I think this is important.
I think the point I'm making here is like there is this question of whether cooperation specifically has declined versus like have these groups that we believe are the reason why people were that at one point were the technology for facilitating that cooperation have declined. And like, I would like to see some more evidence here. So there's one paper that tried to test this specifically about Putnam's piece. This is a 2022 paper called "Did Cooperation Among Strangers Decline in the United States? A Cross-Temporal Meta-Analysis of Social Dilemmas." It looks at data from 1956 to 2017, and they cannot find. This is like they're looking at samples effect sizes involving 63,000 different participants to see if the average level of cooperation has declined at all. They can't find like any evidence for it. Now, again, I'm not saying that it's positive. It's like, again, like it's very difficult for something to like be tested this way. But like, are fewer people, like one of the canonical, like, well, not the canonical, but the opening example in the introduction here is about a guy donating his kidney to someone else. Are there fewer people donating their kidneys now? Like, no. So like, I just like all of these forms of cooperation. And again, like maybe I'm just in many ways like very optimistic about people like helping each other out in this modern, in modern society. But like, in my own personal life, in like the world I observe, in the statistics that I'm able to find, I can't find evidence that people are saying like not helping each other as much. Like people point to these sort of like side trends of like, you don't know your neighbor's name the same way, like whatever. But like, I don't remember I don't know if they listen to the podcast. I don't remember my neighbor's names, but like they technically have our numbers and they ask us to pick up their packages and like we do it. And they don't know our names and like we just do it because we exchange numbers at some point, but like none of us saved each other's fucking names in our phones.
Wait,
and,
why
like,
didn't you save?
I just didn't do it. I didn't do it. What do you want from me? And so okay. I didn't do it. But like, again, my point is like, yeah, I don't know their names. I don't really know what's going on. At like one point we realized like their dog must have died because we didn't see their dog anymore. But like, we don't know a lot about them. And like, people can think that that's sad and like bad or whatever. But like, if the thing that we're worried about is these outcomes, whether it's on education, whether it's on public safety, whether it's about whether or not you donate your kidney to someone who's in need, like, I don't understand why we're focusing on this like strange intermediary potential, like reason why some of this might have declined and not like, hey, what is the best way to increase educational outcomes for children? How do we improve public safety? Does it have anything to do with Rotary clubs? And okay. It's just like confusing to me.
Okay. Text your neighbors though.
Why?
And say like, my name is Jerusalem.
It's too late. I can't do it. Say, like, I've been there for 2 years.
Say, like, I was on a podcast, you know, and yeah. like I had to admit that like I didn't save your name.
You know, my husband might know.
And
we'll
I just want you
yeah.
to know
yeah.
like I'm Jerusalem. You know,
I'm not going to do that.
Just like do a little bit
for what purpose?
For the social capital.
But we already have it. We have the social capital. Why not?
I don't know.
What, no, like, what am I? I mean, I actually think this is useful. Like, what is going to happen? And I feel I hope they're not listening. This is so awkward for them.
You know, what's the harm? You know, it's like Pascal's wager.
But what's the harm is that it's like they're offended by the fact that I don't know their name.
Okay, so let's back out. So here, where I will criticize some of the forecasts in this book. I think have really come true and have really been vindicated. I think particularly Putnam versus the internet optimists on social capital. Total victory. Now, he, you know, because he's left-wing, mm-hmm. he likes this Jacobsian public safety type argument. But in fact, like crime continued falling despite him due to hard coercion and improved surveillance.
And lead. Goodbye, lead.
And lead, you know, but it's like cops have gotten better at solving crimes. There's a myth that that's not true. And I will discuss on another day why that's not true.
I think we've already done that on this podcast.
But like, that's fine. Education got better after we wrote the book and then it got worse again. Yeah. And the reasons for that don't seem
to have anything to do with the Rotary Clubs.
Related yeah. to what's happening here. And I think the big problem with the book, and you see this even more he wrote a follow-up book called The Upswing, which is like really about how he thinks we can like engineer a return.
I haven't read it. What's the take?
What he writes about in The Upswing more is like he mentions in this book that this is not continuous decline in associational life, that there was a rise before the fall that he's mm-hmm. writing about. In The Upswing, he writes more about the rise because he wants to say like we had this rise once and we can do it again. I found that unpersuasive. I think that the clearest evidence in his own book, if you just want to be honest about it, is that these trends are determined by technology mm-hmm. and to a lesser extent by, I don't know what you want to call them, like inspired religious figures.
So what's your take for what happened in the early 1900s?
But there's also a technological.
Oh, you think it's radio?
Change. No. I mean, it's like people actually had time out of nonstop drudgery.
Oh, okay.
I think.
Oh, okay.
That would be my take. That's that it's theory. Like industrialization leads to associational life, but then eventually leads to radio, television, VCRs.
So technology leads to leisure time. Leisure time then gets eaten up by TV.
Yeah, okay, and is eventually devoured by TV and the internet. And so, you know, I think this is like valid to think about and has some downstream consequences, but you then really do need to say like, well, look, like is a strong sense of informal community relationship, like not like is that beneficial to public safety, but like is that the only way we can provide public safety? And it's just no.
Yeah.
Like we can hire law enforcement professionals.
But I'm just like the only way. It just seems actually unclear to me that these things are related. Like it seems unclear to me that like, I mean, when you witness the big ups and downs of crime increasing and decreasing, that they have quite literally anything to do with people going to membership organizations. It's one of those things where it's weird. Like there are a lot of things that you could obviously like do around the edges that could have like impacts on like many things that you care about. But like, I think a clear-eyed view of like approaching the biggest problems in society and then going, what are the top 10 high impact things to do would not lead you at any point to like membership associations when you're talking about crime.
Well, crime maybe. I mean, I don't know. You know, politics, I mean, I do think that this disembodied politics that we now have. Now, he thinks that without a return to, you know, like labor unions and robust associations, we're not going to turn around the low voter turnout that was a big source of social anxiety in the 90s. It turns out that you absolutely can turn around voter turnout without doing that. And it's by having all the politicians be terrible so that people are in a constant state of mass panic about the other side winning.
Yeah.
But I think that like a lot of the like incredibly bad trends in American politics are in fact like downstream of people engaging with the political system in this very disembodied way.
There's a lot in this book about various aspects of political engagement that he is concerned with. I mean, number one way that he's measuring it is really voter turnout. But there's also things like attending local meetings, like whatever, engaging in local government, you know, activities like that. There was this quote that I read once from Robert Dahl, who's a political scientist from the 20th century, that like really, really stuck with me, which is this idea that, yeah, like other performers, including teachers, ministers, and actors, politicians and political activists are prone to overestimate the interest of the audience in their performance. And it's like such a good line, especially for like people like me who spent all my time, well, like a lot of my time focused on how the obsession with getting people back to 60% engagement in local government is like just completely contravening their like stated preferences not to be involved in this sort of thing. And I think that like you have this problem with Putnam too, where he clearly is really uncomfortable with the fact that, you know, people aren't engaging enough in local elected civic life, and he wants to see more of that, and he wants to see higher rates of turnout. But like, you've made this point a lot, which is that like increased engagement in politics has both like likely made people unhappier and made politics worse. And this is, I think, one of the big through lines of the book.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, I think this is like a real, he is assuming that the only way to get people more engaged in politics is through this very high-minded route that he has in mind.
Yeah.
Right. Which is that like people are going to get more involved in different kinds of associations. And then through those associations, they're going to hear from like better informed people about how the work of the political system is impacting the things that those associations care about. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to have this like really constructive, like beneficial engagement in politics. I think as with crime, right, with crime, it just turns out there's like a more direct route to impact the crime rate. And in that case, I think it's just like almost entirely beneficial. With politics, it's like, it turns out that like we did have this withdrawal from engagement as the intermediating institutions that traditionally engage people in politics withered away. So you can just come back in through the back door, right? Through essentially, I mean, what he is not able to know, but I think was a little bit prescient about, is that circa 2000, the internet was a competitor to television.
Yeah.
Because the internet was all text, you know, and like I was an early blogger. It's like all you could put on the internet was text because video would take forever to download. And so there were some people like the old geezers.
Weren't there photos too? Wasn't it like porn?
Yeah, but it wasn't good. Okay. Not that the porn wasn't good. No. But like really, like the whole internet was dominated by text because that was what you had the bandwidth for. And, you know, these like newspaper farts would be like, oh, these blogs, the internet, like it's so terrible. And I would say to them, like, you're thinking about this wrong. Like you're comparing internet discourse to like the best of print media. Mm-hmm. But like what you should compare it to is cable television, which is garbage.
Yeah.
And it's so much better than that. And like this is what we are inventing here. As it turns out, with like a 10 to 15 year lag, the internet is just super television. Like, it's all video, you know, just like TV news was bigger than newspapers. Internet video is way bigger than internet text. Also, as he says, like people did watch news on TV, but they mostly watch things that aren't news. Most internet video content like isn't about anything civic or high-minded at all. Mm-hmm. It's mostly just like a way for people to waste their time. And the main way that people have come to be re-engaged with politics is through sort of internet infotainment type stuff, which has been like quite efficacious. Like small dollar online fundraising is a really, really big deal. Like ephemeral internet-based social movements have become a really, really big deal. People get really emotionally invested in political races in states and congressional districts they don't live in because it like symbolizes things that they care about. People have become actually probably more detached from the like specific concrete political stakes of like elections they can vote in, but like more like engaged with these kind of celebrity figures, right? And that's worse, I think, than just staying at the low level of engagement that Putnam was worried about. But I think it's at least like quasi true that what we are continuing to see is the negative consequences of people not being involved in a consistent way with anything real. It's like people don't know anything about anything.
But I think this is my thing. Like I am truly like mixed on the question of whether people are not engaging with, you know, friends and family enough. Like I think that like stuff has shifted a lot, but like also now you can be in contact with your significant other no matter where you are in the world at any given moment in time. You can be in contact with your friends who live very far away from you. Like people used to like move and then like you'd write letters maybe, or you would like basically maybe never even see your family member again because it was too expensive to like travel back to them.
Did you see, I would tell we need a little like gender slop in every podcast. And he has this thing about how women make way more long distance telephone calls, which is obviously not.
Women be chatting.
Not something you would think to keep statistics on anymore. But yes, I mean, that was the nature of that time was that the fact that somebody didn't live in the same city as you meant that like you might not even be able to talk to them on the phone because you had to pay extra.
And so it's like, to me, it's like, I think that there's often not a really clear theoretical framework for me to think through this stuff, because like I agree that like it's good when you see your friends in person, like that's really valuable and important, but like my father can only talk to his grandmother who lives like countries and countries away because of the internet and because of the cheapening of like long distance telecommunications. And like there are like a lot of people like that who are in different situations. And so like this then becomes a question of like, okay, so like you can become really in touch with and really interact with like people you're very close to and people you already have relationships with. There's like a decline in like kind of these casual relationships and connections that you have in like whether it's churches or whatever it is. And then all of that comes together to what? People still don't say that they're like feeling super disconnected. Our politics feels worse, but there's like even more social engagement happening. And so like, I think that there's like this weird sense that like this is like a quote unquote like solved theory, when I think that like many of the components of it feel like very confusing to me. Because if you'd said 20 years ago, like, hey, like there's going to be, I mean, 10 points more engagement in politics, like he would have been like, yeah, like it's gonna be a much more high social capital country. Clearly that's not happening. If you were to say things like, and I feel very like confused because, like, you know, you look at the social capital index that he created, which is like an index that he's using to like measure how well any given area is doing in terms of its associational life. And some of the stuff he measures is like, you know, makes a lot of sense to me. It's like people who agree that most people can be trusted and that most people are honest. But some of the stuff is like kind of weird, like number of 501c3 nonprofits per 1,000, turnout in these presidential elections, attended any public meeting on town or school affairs in the last year. Those sorts of things, I think, in my case, like I think that they like lean potentially negative or at best neutral. And I think that there's like this like real problem for this theory in that like it doesn't seem like many people who are talking about it seem super interested in getting at like, what is the core thing that we're trying to shift to make the world a better place? And I think this, it results in his solutions and the solutions part of the book, which is like civics education. And we need extracurricular activities that kids are going to. And I'm like, I don't know. Like, I keep reading about how actually kids are doing way too many extracurricular activities. And it's like, I actually feel confused about like what it is that people want to see happen. And that would convince them that this theory was wrong.
Well, I think this like really set the template for like all 21st century big ideas books of where you're like supposed to have this solutions chapter at the end and it's really unpersuasive.
Yeah.
You know, I try not to write my books that way, but
your book is like all solutions.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
like 1 billion Americans, like very, very, very deliberately does not try to convince you at all that like the United States of America being eclipsed by the People's Republic of China would be bad. I'd say that it would be bad.
Yeah.
And I like quote a few people being like, I agree. And I'm like, there is widespread consensus that this would be bad.
Yeah.
And I did get some reviews. Like I think in the New Republic, they were like, who's to say? Like, but like, it's fine. And like, I just wanted to write a book of solutions. And I think I've got a lot of solutions and I think they're pretty persuasive and it's really good. And I wish more people had sort of inside out books like that, but it's just not the way of the 21st century you know, nonfiction book. And I'm there like, yes, like I am completely aligned. Like the things that he is suggesting seem underpowered, except for like, again, he's like, perhaps a really persuasive prophet will come along and we'll have a new great awakening of religion. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, I feel weird writing that. And I'm like, yeah, I agree you should. And I think there's a, you know, a long tradition of like largely secular Reform Jews looking at America and being like, maybe you guys should go to church more. And, you know, maybe you should. I don't know what's going on. With everybody out there in the goy world, but it's it makes me wonder at times, because it really was the case until quite it continues to be true that like America is more religious than European countries, but it's like falling like a rock. And I feel like people don't talk enough, not like pro or con, you know, but just like descriptively. Like a lot of people have remarked on the fact that Donald Trump is an influential person in American politics. Mm-hmm. And that seems different from the kinds of people who were influential in American politics previously.
Yeah.
And like they feel something about it. And like that is clearly a consequence, I think, of secularization, mm-hmm. right, has like driven this whole realignment, because like Donald Trump was a Democrat in the 1990s. And I don't think he was all that different mm-hmm. from how he is today. But just like being a guy who didn't go to church, who didn't think that like hectoring people about premarital sex was like a really high value use of his time, right? Like that just like meant you were a Democrat.
I mean, this is like the Ross Douthat that like, if you guys hate the religious conservatives, get ready for what comes next.
Sort of. Yeah. Except like Ross says it in this like weird threatening way. I was like enough.
I mean, sounds kind of like what you're saying.
No, but like I was enough down on the old moralizing Christian right that I'm kind of like, you know, part of what's happened here is that we've won a lot of arguments that were once very pressing. And we're now in this like decayed form of American conservatism that will like no longer offer like Christianity and scolding as the kind of solution to everything.
But don't you want that? Isn't that kind of the whole
maybe
thing?
Yes, maybe. Yeah. I mean, it depends, you know, like I think all left-wing people like underrate the extent to which we thought gay rights was a really big deal 25 years ago and have just won.
Mm-hmm.
And like don't ever want to like take credit or take a victory lap and stuff around that. The like way the pro-life movement collapsed as soon as they got Roe v. Wade repealed is like striking and an important aspect of politics. I think it is also true, though, that we are living through a lot of downside of a sort of a de-Christianized America that a lot of secular, cosmopolitan-minded people wish that conservative-minded people were more invested in Christian universalism and Christian humanism, because they've just become selfish mm-hmm. and kind of like foreigners. I don't give a shit, right? Like that kind of thing. And like I do give a shit and have like a secular cosmopolitan worldview mm-hmm. that like I can really explain. But we've won on the secular and not really won on the cosmopolitan humanism. We've created just more of a selfish center to American politics. And like, that's very much a mixed blessing. But like, it's the thing that happened. It's not that like suddenly everybody got super right wing. It's like they got less religious, mm-hmm. which is less right wing in many, many important ways, but it is more avaricious.
Yeah. I mean, I think that like this gets at a question that, you know, I've talked about before, which is how much of what is valuable about whether it's going to church or all these other things is the true belief that people have, and how much of it is like just you go to church and then there's like this other technology that goes on. And like, I think a lot of people who are not religious, I mean, I get the sense from that in this book from Putnam, is that like the value that he thinks exists is that you are just going to community church. You're going to a community meeting every week and like you're interacting with people, like there's someone to take care of your kids, like whatever. And that the belief is like doing like very little or like nothing. And like, I think this is like wrong. I think that like the belief is like doing a lot there, and that like people having a strong moral framework that they can like refer to for like better or worse action is like genuinely like a, it's like a devastating thing not to have. Like, I don't actually understand like how people sort of like don't feel like super, I mean, maybe they do, like super nihilistic when they don't have anything, either whether it's a moral framework that they've thought through or it's a religious framework that like they use to like figure out what's right and wrong, and what's also like helps them deal with like the despair of like when things that are horrible happen and like you have no control over it. And I think that like part of what's going on here is that if religious groups are explain nearly all the decline in attending religious services and being a part of a religion, explain nearly all of what Putnam is talking about, it becomes even more unclear to me in that situation whether it really is the associational life that is the problem, or it's that like now in the absence of having some sort of moral framework that people can revisit in community, whether it's with your priest or with your friends or whatever, you have like something that you can return to. People are turning to like other forms of morality that are like much, much worse. Whether it's like the like weird, I guess we're doing gender slop, the weird gender slop, like bioessentialism that you see online now, where you have like people talking about like the divine feminine and like the divine masculine. It's like this like really poorly thought through ideas that get like millions and millions of people's engagement with, because like they don't really know what to do with it. And I think that explains a lot of like the rise in like astrology or like whatever it is. And I'm like, you know, like whatever. I think it's like fun to talk about like how I'm an Aries or whatever. But like, I do think that there are some people who take it like very, very seriously because they don't have anything else to engage with. And like, I know people who have been like, I'm not going to go on a date with this person because they have like this, like, you know, a star sign, or like we're trying to figure out a person to add to our community house. And like, you know, like Capricorns are not a protected class, but like maybe they should be, because there are people who are like not letting you live with them. Anyway, these are very niche kind of a community.
Yeah, but so I mean, I think something that's in the text that I think was interesting that he was onto so long ago is that he flags that the younger cohorts are more significantly more materialistic. And this is something cohorts that were literally not born at the time he wrote this book have continued this trend very markedly. And he doesn't write about this at great length. He mentions it, but I think it's interesting because this is something that has like really zoomed forward. That like the share of people who say, you know, the most important thing is just like making money is way up across, you know, across time. And it's very cohort driven.
Yeah, we found that in our poll. Like, we looked at, like, we talked about this in our poll that we released in our elites, and like, you don't see a big difference between men and women in saying that they think that, you know, having a family is more important than a career. But if you look at the cohorts, like, young people are like way more likely to be like, yeah, career is it. And like, maybe that's also that, like, you know, they're not married yet. And they don't have family,
well, no, so but- I mean, right. But this is why I think some of the findings that he has are telling about this, because some of it is like a period effect, right?
Yeah.
Like, you get older, most people do get married and have children, and presumably that then like elevates in its ranking. But he is showing that like generations that are now dead just like started at a higher level of investment in like family relative to money. And, you know, this is an interesting change in our society that, again, I think people like maybe know has happened, but aren't thinking about it clearly enough when they characterize. Like, something that is very notable to me right now is that left-wing politics is very selfish in contemporary American left. It's not solidarity politics.
I actually don't know if that's true. I mean, like, isn't it like, I think it's very, very team-based. Like, they will forgive Zohar Mamdani anything.
No, but that's not what I mean. Okay. Team-based, like literally, like, what is the economic policy ideas that they are talking about,
oh,
right? They're not talking about broad-based taxation to provide a broad-based social safety net. They're not talking about America's unusually high level of child poverty.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's, you have a lot of people who are like broadly middle class saying they want more you know, from the government. And then you have this big, like, rationalizing class talking about, like, oh, today's young college graduates are, like, so much more screwed than anybody else. And you look at the stats and you're like, you know, if you, like, really torture the data, you can make it say that. Mm-hmm. But, like, you know, the people who are 25 today are on average better off than the people who are 25 20 years ago who were better off than the people 40. It's just like the upward march of progress continues. What has actually changed is that today's 25-year-olds are more materialistic and more selfish than today's 65-year-olds were when they were 25. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that it's going to work, right? It's like the left is like defined down its economic aspirations to like, we're going to tax like just Mark Zuckerberg and he's going to pay for everything. We're going to have a middle class tax cut, property tax cuts, but also Medicare for all, mm-hmm. et cetera. And then on the right, there's been this kind of parallel evolution to, you know, like abandoning PEPFAR, abandoning any sense that we should care about refugees or asylum, you know, and there's like some analytic like disagreements about what is the actual impact of immigration policy, but just like also a real like, fuck you, I've got mine attitude that expresses itself different. There's a distinct like left wing and right wing versions of it, but they're both like very much like I, college graduate sitting here on my laptop in my nice air conditioned house and getting screwed by the elites, mm-hmm. you know, and like I should get more instead of, I don't know, like the kind of stuff that like got me interested in progressive politics in the first place was like, I'm doing okay in, and not to be like woke 1.0 constant privilege checking, but like everybody deserves access to a great public school and to safe streets, and that in the richest country on earth, people should get medical care.
But
when
you
they
didn't
want
even have access to a good public school. You had to go to private
blah,
school.
Sure.
How sad for you.
I'm doing good though. But people who seem objectively speaking like they're doing fine by like global or historical standards feel or express the idea that like they personally are like the victims of these like incredible
I think,
forces.
I
find it very alienating. I'm just like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
I mean, I do think, I mean, we had like last year, I think I had Sahil Chinoy, who has this great paper about zero sum views mm-hmm. and where they come from. And like looking at the cohort effect of like which cohorts have these like views that like, you know, someone else getting more is undercutting them. And I mean, like, it's not like, I mean, I think it's related to what you're saying here around like when you look at anti-immigration discourse on the right and they're talking about how, you know, immigrants are coming in and taking up homes from them. And like, it sounds very similar to like how left wingers in progressive cities will say like, well, don't come here and take these homes, gentrifiers. And like, you know, I think that there's like a worse moral harm being done to refugees than in the other case. But I still think it's the exact same kind of like logic about zero sum attitudes towards like scarce goods. And, you know, I think that like this cohort question here is also just a question. I mean, and Chinoy's paper is around like, did you kind of come up at a time of like rapid economic growth or not? And like, this explanation to me makes a lot more sense for why people feel this way than like the sort of decline in associational life that we've been talking about. Because like what Chinoy finds and also his co-authors is that if you grew up at a time where there's like a lot of economic growth happening, you're just like more, you're like less likely to hold these views around like someone else getting theirs is going to hurt you. And these sorts of like bigger material explanations, I mean, like in the book, you call out technology, but I think that like these much bigger shifts have a lot more to say. And like the reason why I keep like harping on this too is I do think there's actually a ton of wasted time being spent on solutions that will do like absolutely nothing and probably make the problem worse. Like lots and lots of people are spending a lot of time trying to get people to build more of these 501c3s or whatever. And like what I keep finding is like how easily astroturfed groups are seen as like this pinnacle of like community engagement or whatever. And like you see this in places all over the country where you have, you know, someone spins up a Facebook group in Minnesota and says like, we're like a bird defending group and we're gonna like now be seen by the local and state community as like really representative of this population. And like it's literally being often case like funded or helped by like local laws. Like they're funding the existence of these groups often that end up like reducing, I think, the efficacy of the government. And like, I think that like sometimes, I mean, some people might hear this critique as being like unfair because, I mean, I know Matt, you kind of feel this way around like his book, because he gets this big arc of what's going to happen in American civic life, correct? But I do think it's really, really a problem that people are investing so much energy into solutions that are just not going to do anything. All right, we'll take a quick break and be right back.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here. And if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
I don't see that much energy. I agree narrowly that like his specific claim that like, well, if we had more 501c3 nonprofits, like that would be good. There's a problem there where, you know, when you start measuring something and it becomes the target, it stops being valid, yeah. Right? That, you know, I think he should have thought harder about that specific proposition. I see a world in which the mainstream of politics is dominated by this quest for who is the villain who is responsible for everything being worse than mm-hmm. it used to be. And we have this really ferocious debate about whether the reason life is worse than it was a generation ago is successful businessmen mm-hmm. or immigrants.
Or Jews.
And that these are the only things that people really want to argue about. And like, is life worse than it was a generation or two ago? By almost every metric, no. Mm-hmm. Right? One of the only ways in which you can really say there has been a change, you could say it was changed for the better, but like a dramatic change that isn't obviously for the better, is that like people are spending way more time alone, mm-hmm. engaged with their entertainments, and less time both in like formal meetings and like with friends, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That to me seems like most plausibly like the thing that makes the people who do feel doomy feel doomy. I think it's fine that there's people like you who don't feel doomy about the world, who like also feel really good about like.
But are these the same people? I think that's my question. Like the people who are saying they feel really doomy, who are driving a lot of this bad vibes, right? Who are like, you know, they work in media or they work in politics or they work in tech and they have like tons of discursive power over how, mm-hmm. You know, what books are written and the vibe of what entertainment gets made. Are those the same people who are seeing this mass decline in associational life? And that seems like not true to me. Like if you look at largely what's happening, it's happening in like lower income communities. It's happening in places where like people have like very little impact on,
Well, two things. It's happening. The levels are different, but yes. The rate of decline is happening everywhere. But also it's not just like complainers in the media. Like we see in the election results mm-hmm. that like people are authentically choosing to vote for politicians who speak to their sense of gloom and doom and declinism.
But I think those are happening mostly in primaries of a highly selected population of almost exactly who I'm talking about.
Well, sure. I mean, I guess the primaries are, but I don't know. Like, I think it's general elections too. Like, I think like a big problem that Hillary Clinton and Kamala Harris both faced is that they didn't like, quote unquote, connect.
Well, why don't you think that why don't you see this more in this descriptive statistics thing? Like, why is it that when people are asked broadly, like, hey, like, do you feel like really disaffected? Why aren't they all just like, yeah, I'm super lonely. I'm super disaffected. I'm super unhappy. You just don't see them saying this.
Well, that's one poll series, but like you ask them, like, is the country on the right track?
Yes.
You ask them, like, are like all politicians scumbags who need
but
to be
flayed? But that's, I think, actually important here. Like, you know, we're aligning the differences between what we're talking about, right? Because you're saying the one thing that you could really, one of the only things you can really see is shifting over this time period is this decline in associational life. But then, now what you're talking about is actually people think that the country's on the wrong track, which could, again, be for like completely unrelated reasons.
No, sure. Yes. Yes. I mean, I agree. I'm just saying, like, if I were to say, if I'm like up there, right, and it's like the people demand
yeah.
that I propose some kind of dramatic burn it down change to yeah. our society, because like they do. And I'm like trying to think like what could I possibly mm-hmm. offer them? Like if we like eliminated all the immigrants, things would get worse. If we end capitalism, things will get worse.
And all zoning regulations.
If I can get everybody to like put down the fucking short form videos and like go play poker. Like, I think things might get better.
Do you? I mean, I actually think that, you know, one thing that's really interesting is, and I actually don't mean this as a dunk at all, is that Putnam does this interview with the New York Times where the interviewer asks him, like, you know, like, oh, so, you know, it's like, what associations are you part of? And it's like, becomes extremely clear that he's like not part of like any of them. Like, he says his wife is in some, but like, he's not really in them. And like, if, like, you know, if this ends up being like really the thing that like association life is important, you're saying the thing I can offer people is get off your phones. But it seems like even the person who really, really believes this the most, like, cannot get himself to just do the thing that he says is the most important thing to revive American democracy and civic life. And so, like, if you're correct, you're just like, you're like, it's over.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. Like, okay. I think these things can be collective, though. You know, like, I used to be very addicted to cigarettes.
Yeah.
And like, my official position was that, like, that was bad.
Yeah.
You know? But, like, I could not stop smoking.
Yeah.
And, like, there was a legal change so that, like, you couldn't smoke in bars and coffee shops in Washington, D.C. And, like, that gave me the kick in the ass that I needed to quit smoking. You know? And, like, so you can be, like, hypocritical about these things, or you can be, like, all part of a superstructure or whatever. But, like, what you can't do is, like, tell somebody who, like, has no lung capacity.
Yeah.
That, like, billionaires and immigrants are, like, the reason they can't breathe. And, like, they're using all this air, you know, and, like, their data centers. It's like, no, it's like, you got to quit smoking, right? If, like, that's what's making you unhealthy.
Yeah.
Like, you've got to do the thing. And, like, I just don't, I don't know. Maybe the answer is that YIMBYism will solve all these problems. Like, I do, like, sometimes toy with that. And that it's like, no, actually, all this is, like, downstream of housing. Even Putnam, yeah, way ahead of it, was, yeah, like, maybe people didn't have to commute as far.
I mean, I tried looking into it, and, like, I just, like, maybe places with higher density would have, like, higher rates of social capital, which would seems like it should be the case if you buy the whole, like, interactions with other people. But, like, the best case for this thesis is that actually that right now you don't see that because it's undercut by an insufficient focus on public safety. And so, like, and good public schools. And so, like, you need density, but you also need, like, people to feel safe and for there to be good schools so they can, like, stay there when they have children. And so, like, maybe, like, dense places with those outcomes will do that. But then, of course, you get massive confounding variables.
No, but I thought he actually underplayed this point about small towns versus, yeah, metro areas, because it
I just meant I look separately.
Oh, sure. Yeah. But I mean, because it doesn't lend itself to solutions.
Yeah.
But, like, quite intuitively, if you live in a community that is not well spatially integrated into other communities, you will just keep bumping into the same people at the same,
yes,
stuff. Like, when I was in Maine, you know, like, you
Gilmore Girls life up there.
You see, we go to the same place for pizza every Thursday night. Mm-hmm. And you see people there who, like, my son knows from his camp. And, like, you just keep running into people in different contexts.
Yeah.
You keep bouncing into them. And, you know, if you have a group of 1,000 people who you keep interacting with in different contexts, half of them, you'll be like, these are sub-average people. I don't like them that much. But the other ones, you find for each of them the context in which you do like doing things with them.
Yeah.
And then it happens, right? There are really good reasons why most people don't live in small towns.
Yeah.
And why, like, you know, it's hard to verbiage, but it's like the growth of the suburbs has been the growth of big metro areas,
mm-hmm,
you know, even more. There's been some flight from central cities, but a lot of it is agglomeration of people from around or small towns. Like, he talks about New England, right? And all these once independent towns in the Boston area are now part of the Boston metro suburbs. And it's much better in, like, most ways and more practical to live in a large geographically integrated metropolitan area. But it does just have this kind of natural consequence that, like, you might have a fair amount in common, like, randomly,
mm-hmm,
with the guy who lives three blocks from you, but, like, you would never come to know that,
yeah,
right? And
certainly,
you know,
not me. I definitely wouldn't come,
right,
to
that. No, but, like, we see this with all kinds of things where, like, dating apps, like, theoretically are, like, a more efficient way to sort through.
I mean, they end up I mean, you see increase in the sort of matching as a result of dating
apps. Just like, right. Yeah. But it's like everything becomes less cross-cutting,
yes.
right? It's like, yes. it's less likely that you will discover hidden yes. connections with other people, and you just hang out with people who are like exactly like you or working your same thing. And there's just, it's just one of these things where like most changes in life have like some downsides,
yeah.
even though it's like, this is why I think he doesn't dwell on it, even though he has the findings. Like, to just be like, well, maybe everyone should live in a small town is like, well, like, no, like, they're not yeah. going to. We're not going to uninvent cars. We're not going to unbuild highways. We'd all be way poorer.
This is just a zoning problem. We just got to zone suburbs to be more like mixed use, small.
He makes this pitch for like, because he's pre-YIMBY yeah. discourse. So he's like a new urbanist. But I think like new urbanism was like a huge conceptual dead end.
It did not work. I mean, I do. One area that I think we didn't talk about was like kind of the workplace, because there's a sort of, I mean, obviously he does this, anti-second wave feminism, or I'll say second wave feminism skeptical bit of the book. But like what you see in that time period is like a bunch of women going into the office, and it's plausible, right, that like the workplace is where a lot of people meet friends, they date, like whatever it is. And you would think that like it was, you would imagine that like even if associational life in certain respects dropped off, that like the interactions you're having in the office and the workplace would have like some big countervailing effect. You don't really, like at least Putnam doesn't really find that. I didn't independently look into it. But
well,
I also
think he's a lot more left wing than you're giving him credit for, though, because like he's putting a lot of weight on the decline of labor unions yeah. as well in this whole story, you know, which is like he feels that like you and your coworkers should be like banding together.
I'm a management,
and going on
so
strike.
I can't.
Yeah. Much as I appreciate some of this book,
yeah.
like I was in a labor union at one point, which was fine. Mm-hmm. But the part of it that was least fine mm-hmm. was like nothing to do with the collective bargaining agreement or the paying of the dues or anything. It was like the sense that like maybe I should go to this meeting.
But that's the problem. I mean, like one thing I thought is like, you know, like obviously COVID happened and a bunch of things go, you know, wrong at the same exact time. And like the argument is like an in-person workspace. I mean, So Boring for a long time has been like working in person with various, other people because, you know, it just, we find it valuable and it's good. But like, I think that if you were to describe a test of like, would associational life just mechanically increasing it in one area change a lot. The staggered return to work is like a perfect test case for this, because you should be able to see like people who are very similar in similar roles, like people who return to the office, like are they doing much better on these like measures of civic engagement? I don't know if anyone's done this. I mean, I would expect that they're happier, but
I was actually just saying that like going to meetings like really sucks. Like yeah. not with like, yeah, like I went to a PTO meeting this week mm-hmm. because I like believe in it as yeah. a civic function.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like I want to be involved. Mm-hmm. Like I want to know when the pizza party is.
Can't they just send you an email?
And if somebody needs help, they will eventually, but it's like I'm trying to be a good social capitalist.
I'm not gonna decline.
But it's like actually being in the meeting and like listening to other people's questions that I don't care about.
I think other people like that, Matt.
Some people do, but I think they mostly don't. No. I mean, yeah. I think this is like an important.
No, I think a lot of people really like me. I'm like a very like low meeting person, but like I find people who are just like, oh man, complaining about meetings, but they're like excited to go to the meeting, actually. Not us.
It's out there. But like, you know, again, it is true that it is probably better for society at the margin if everybody spent 90 minutes less per week watching their favorite videos mm-hmm. and spent 90 minutes more in like earnest meetings mm-hmm. listening patiently. But it is actually way more boring. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like I personally enjoy watching my favorite internet videos a lot more than I enjoy listening to a PTO meeting. And like I still believe
yeah.
that like the social function, the 3 minutes out of the 90 in the meeting that like are valuable create positive value
yeah.
in a way that like watching YouTube shorts doesn't. But it's like I think it's really hard. It's like harder than he's making it out to be for like earnest meetings to compete with fun entertainment.
That's why it's called Bowling Alone. not meeting together.
Fair enough.
So I think it's a great place to wrap up. As you guys heard, this is a book that was suggested by a reader of The Argument or Slow Boring. So
make your parasocial relationship with us your substitute for social capital.
Exactly.
Tell your friends, tell your family, like, subscribe, follow, make other people you know also listen to this podcast so you can have some common thread, you know, hold society together.
And suggest books. You can do that in the comments of either The Argument or Slow Boring. And we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Ryan Seacrest here. So every great barbecue takes a little patience. And while the food does its thing, you can enjoy a little Chumba Casino. The perfect recipe. Chumba Casino. Always good to have you back.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.